This is Scott Becker with the Becker Group Business Leadership Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by a really interesting twosome. We've got Jordan Blaschak and Chris Haw. They are a Republican and a Democrat, or a Democrat and a Republican, that have co-authored a book about politics in America right now, and thrilled to hear some of their perspectives. Jordan, do you want to take a moment and introduce yourself and also tell us the name of the book and so forth?
Absolutely. Well, Scott, first, thank you so much for having us on. We're thrilled to get to talk to you and your audience. Our book is called Union, A Democrat, A Republican in a Search for Common Ground. And just for quick backgrounds on the two of us, I spent 5 years in the Marines as a Marine infantry officer, spent two tours overseas leading troops, and left the Marine Corps and went off to law school. And at law school, I happened to meet Chris, and we were new friends. And about 9 months later, got started on this project. And Chris, do you want to say a bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, good to be here. My name is Chris Haw, and I come from Berkeley, where I was born, raised, and educated. I went from there to the State Department, where I was a speechwriter to the secretary under the Obama administration. And after that, I went to law school where I met this guy.
So it was the Marines, the State Department, and law school. Where were the people the most combative?
That's a great question. Probably law school. I think law school attracts a kind of person who likes to fight and likes to argue. So that was definitely the most political environment that both of us were in. I think one thing that did draw us together initially was that both the Marine Corps and the State Department kind of transcend party. In the Marines, no one really knows what party someone comes from. We probably talk politics, but we do so from a very apolitical perspective. And Chris likes to say that at the State Department, you can quote Reagan and Kennedy in the same breath. And so there's really no issue with being postpartisan or transpartisan. And I think it was a bit of a shock to both of us once we got to law school, just how political and argumentative it could be.
Now, law school, and we'll take a moment further on that, has really been awash for a long time in the politically correct culture and the cancel culture. And then it really leads to strong reactions as well. Can you take one moment on that?
Yeah, well, I can jump in here a little bit. I mean, I think Jordan probably has a somewhat different perspective on law school than I did, being a conservative. I felt like I was amongst my crowd many days as a liberal, as a progressive from Berkeley. And what really spawned this book, though, is that it didn't feel like we were getting the full picture of the country from our perch in New Haven. It felt like, especially in 2015 and 2016, when we first met, that there's a larger story that maybe we weren't really seeing because of this sort of block of thinking. I thoroughly enjoyed law school. I met a lot of great people, including Jordan, but it really spawned this itch in us to get out and see things.
When you're at a place like Yale, is it fair to say that if there's 175 students in each class, that it is truly predominantly a progressive group? So Chris, you felt very much at home, and Jordan felt very much on the defensive at times.
It's a good question. So the law school is interesting because the faculty skews pretty heavily towards the progressive side. I think there might have been one conservative faculty member while we were there. But the student body, while probably overwhelmingly progressive, I'd say there's 20-30% who are conservative and part of the Federalist Society, which is extremely powerful. And so the student conservatives are extremely articulate. They're sort of always eager for political engagement and combat, and they're a strong force on campus, and that was definitely a feature of our experience as well.
One more question, and I'll take you to your book. True or false? Yale is a much better law school than Harvard Law School.
I say true.
Chris, obviously true.
Talk to us about your book and the state of partisanship in the U.S. today. Jordan, do you want to start?
Yes, happy to. So, you know, what we found when we took to the road was that there was almost this universal bewilderment about what was happening to us. Everyone we talked to was dismayed about the state of our national politics, why we were so polarized, and generally lamenting the fact that we've entered this place where conservatives and liberals can't seem to talk to each other anymore. And when we first heard that on the road, we thought it was fascinating because the media narratives and political narratives that we hear all the time are just dominated by this idea that the two sides in America are irreconcilable at the moment. And so as we set off on the road to explore what really was pulling us apart and what could bring us back together, I think that initial sense of, you know, Americans don't really want to be so polarized, and yet there are things driving them into certain camps, was kind of the dominant feature we saw. And it led us to this view that there's probably 80-90% agreement among Americans on most issues, and it's the 10-20% that we seem to fight viscerally over. And it's because we never lift up that other 80% and talk about the shared values and shared beliefs and goals that we have as a country. That's just sort of a feature now of the political and media landscape. And so that actually gave us a lot of hope that there is this latent common ground to be found, and you just have to go search for it.
And Chris, let me ask you to address the same question. And Jordan says, look, the reality is, and this has been proven true at the Supreme Court level, that literally Supreme Court justices agree on about 90% plus of issues, not even 80-90%, 90% plus. But the focus is always in that 5-10% where there's visceral disagreement. Chris, if you listen to CNN or if you listen to President Trump or Fox News, you would never come to the perspective that Americans are really in agreement on 80-90%+ of issues. Your perspective on that, is that a fair assessment? And then how do we get past those 10% of issues that are tearing us apart?
Absolutely. I think that's very fair. I had an old writing mentor, a journalism mentor, who said, go to the scene. And that was his ethos. And that's an ethos that I've tried to carry forward. And I really think that that's the truth here, is that when you watch cable news, when you solely see the rhetoric in our politics, then you only see that 10% or largely see that 10%. Really, when you get out on the road, when you see people, when you talk to them, you start hearing a different kind of language being spoken, and it's a language that transcends political difference. We all sort of carry very similar values, very similar desires for life, and you only see that when you get out there, like I said. So, yeah, the question of what to do with it, how to deal with this situation, how to maybe remedy that discrepancy, that's the trillion-dollar question, right? I mean, that's an impossibility almost. I would point to social media. We need to do something there, whether it's regulation or whether it's just the outcry of the population saying we need a better system. I think it's how we fund our elections. I need to put part of it at the feet of our media, even though I consider myself a journalist now, and I love many journalists. I think we need to do a better job. I think it starts there, and I think we all need to sort of look inward and see the ways in which we're contributing to it.
Let me ask you a couple follow-up questions. CNN is sort of a perfect example. It was mired in third in the ratings behind Fox and MSNBC. It decided it no longer wanted to be down the middle, which was clearly just a losing commercial proposition, and decided it would take one of the flanks. Is this where the media has to go to be successful, or can you still be sort of traditional journalism? And that's not a knock on CNN. It's an observation that they were really mired behind MSNBC. They decided to take that flank. They now seem to be doing as well or better than MSNBC. You don't even hear about MSNBC anymore. Is that the position the media has to take to win? And then I want to ask you about a couple of the other issues with the media. Any thoughts on that? Is that on the media?
Yeah.
I'll start, and Chris can jump in. This is something that Chris and I have actually talked a lot about over the last year, this question of media business models and how it's driving things in certain directions. You know, we can tell you from personal experience that we've been told often by different media outlets and people in the book world that, writing a book about common ground and kind of articulating something more uplifting and hopeful that can bring us all together just doesn't sell, because that's not what people want. And whether that's true or not, that's clearly what the data is telling some of these organizations. And it's no surprise that different groups are acting in line with that. I think one thing Chris and I have come to is that there is something very special about the media, and specifically journalism, and the role it plays in our democracy. And it might not be best left to the free market to determine how we set up our journalistic industry in the United States, and whether that means we need to carve out a special space for journalists to operate without having to face the same financial pressures that happen in the private sector. Maybe it requires a nonprofit model or government funding in order to carve that out. But the current system is dragging the media companies and journalists into this fuzzy realm where it's not quite pure journalism and it's not quite pure enterprise. And that is, in my view, somewhat deranging our media landscape.
Well, it is, but isn't it scary to have the idea, when we talk about government-funded media or more government-regulated media, don't we feel more like the Pravda of the Soviet Union? And isn't that quite scary as well?
Yeah, especially if you go to that poll. But, you know, I think on the other end of the spectrum, the United States has a great history of philanthropic funded enterprises that aren't quite for profit and they're not quite public sector, and they operate in this for public benefit space. So I think that's a possibility. I think the BBC in the UK provides another interesting model where it does get some government subsidies. It's able to operate a little bit free in according to a more pure journalistic ethos than we necessarily see in the U.S. And so I think there is a space for it that avoids the sort of fear of government manipulation and an intrusion that you might see in a more autocratic state. But Chris knows a lot more about this than me. So Chris, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I'll only say, I mean, I love nonprofit news. I think ProPublica, the Marshall Project, there's great models out there. I haven't given up on private sector news yet. I think that our media changes. It goes through waves. I still think there's a lot of very good journalists working out there, but I also think Jordan's right that there are serious issues within the media space as to how we govern these institutions. So, you know, we've been through these cycles before through history. I mean, I don't want to go too deep here. And I think that there are market solutions to this. It's just a question of how do we find them? Do we counterbalance it with nonprofit news? Are there sort of neutral principles that the government can follow that doesn't infringe on the First Amendment and the press clause? And are there ways that they can support the work of sort of free, good, independent journalism? And I think there are. It's just a matter of time and hashing them out.
Well, you certainly said it right. Both of you guys have hit this very well. I mean, certainly we've been through periods of time this before where the media was accused of yellow journalism, was accused of other things, of trying to really take positions on things versus being truly journalist. And certainly the BBC is probably the best of the models. I'm not sure some of the other ones that were mentioned are really as unbiased as maybe projected, but the BBC is sort of known as the most centrist of them at all. So great, great thoughts and comments. So the next question, I guess, which is sort of like, you know, this fascinating thing, President Trump, whether right or wrong on a host of issues, does he create so much conflict, and our country's just so sick of the cauldron of conflict that he ends up getting voted out this November? And that's not a comment on how he's done, what he does, but he does seem to be a lightning rod for controversy. Does he get voted out this November? Jordan, do you want to take a first crack at that?
Sure. Well, Chris and I have no particular insight into the upcoming election. I think we saw a lot of this country from the road, and for the most part tried to steer away from politics with the people we were meeting. We were trying to understand something a little bit deeper about America through engaging with people in the areas of life that matter to them, like work, family, faith, and deeper values. So we don't have any particular insight into who's going to win. And I think projecting out this far away is kind of a fool's errand. I feel like every week of 2020 feels like a lifetime. And so who knows what 3 weeks or 3 months are going to look like from here. I will say that, you know, one thing Chris and I found was that politics is inherently divisive. It's meant to be a fight because we're always trying to separate who's on my team and who's not on my team. And so there's this endless effort at line drawing. And I think one of the challenges of the last 4 years, and to your point about the president being a lightning rod, is that every time he inserts himself into an issue, it's going to be extremely polarized as a result. And so it doesn't matter how big or small, anytime the president does or says something, there's going to be half the country that immediately responds with a visceral repulsion. And so that is, again, just a feature of life today.
It really is. And Chris, you know, Jordan has said it's a fool's errand to predict what will happen this November. You're both brilliant and from Yale, so I'm going to invite you into the fool's errand. Can I get you to make a prediction or no?
Well, I'll tell you, in 2016, Jordan and I had this exact conversation, and I told him that it was a mathematical impossibility that Donald Trump would become president. So ever since then, I have certainly sworn off predictions. but I do think Jordan is right. And I also think that, the honest truth is that the way to sort of remedy our politics is to get away from politics. I was able to get along with Trump supporters on the road when we started talking about family, when we started talking about what it's like to be a truck driver in this day and age, what it's like to come out of prison, whatever the issue on someone's mind, and instead of talking about, whatever is in the headlines that day. That doesn't bode well for making a prediction on Trump, since we tried to get away from it as much as we possibly could. But I do think that it speaks to the sort of 80% that we were talking about, that there is this language out there that people speak, even if the president is trying to make sure that we don't speak it as much as we could.
And Jordan, let me ask you a question. Chris made a comment, and you have to let me know, and just judging the inherent bias of things, he said that when Trump supporters get out of prison, he talks to them and doesn't get that and gets great clarity about what they're thinking. Any thoughts on that? No, that's a total paraphrase and an unfair statement, Chris. I'm just kidding entirely. Any sense, though? I mean, at the end of the day, most of us want safety. Most of us want financial security. Most of us want jobs. Most of us want an international situation that's relatively sane. There was a great degree of the country that disagreed with Obama policies, and there's a great degree of the country that disagrees with Trump's behavior, if not his policies, and they often get tied together. And so is there a way forward? Is this going to get better? Jordan, do you want to take the quick lead on that? And then, Chris, is this going to get better in our country, or is it destined for to be in a debacle in a civil war?
So Chris and I think, ended our trips very hopeful that things will get better and that there is a path forward to a better shared future for the country. And a lot of that was driven by the people we saw on the ground. We think there's this amazing American ethos of serving your community, trying to do right by your neighbors, and working to solve the hard problems we face at the local level. And having seen that in town after town, city after city, we have a lot of faith that there are good people working to solve these problems we face. There's no doubt that we have very deep problems. And I think one of the amazing things about American history is that every 60, 80 years or so, we go through these very tumultuous periods because the economic and government kind of system we've had up until that point is just no longer quite working because the environment has changed so dramatically. You know, what America looked like 60 years ago is so different from today. So it makes sense that the bureaucracy we've created to administer government policy or the economic system that we've been using just ceases to really deliver to the American people the things we all agree we want, like better education, better healthcare, more opportunity, better jobs. And so it is just a feature of life that we're going to go through these tumultuous periods as the country reinvents itself in order to meet those. And we've always done it in the past. America has this incredible ability to reinvent and renew. And I think what we saw on the road leads us to believe that that's going to happen again.
And Chris, any final comments on that? And then Chris or Jordan, can you tell us again the title of the book and I assume people can find the book every place. Both of you are brilliant and a pleasure to visit with. Thank you. Chris, any final thoughts on whether this gets better, and then also the title of the book and where we can find it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the title of the book is Union, A Democrat, A Republican, and A Search for Common Grounds, and you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local independent bookstore. It should be everywhere books are sold, or nearly everywhere. And yeah, I mean, I would just echo what Jordan said, which is that this is a book about hope, and that ultimately we believe that what we saw was a nation of workers, a nation of people willing to roll up their sleeves and do the work of making our country a more perfect union, to right the wrongs and highlight the good and move forward. So we are very, very, very hopeful. And if you want a dose of that this summer, and maybe a few road trips to reminisce about when we all could do that, pick up a copy of Union.
Jordan, Chris, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Just brilliant and a pleasure to visit with you. Thank you very much.
Scott, thank you. This was a pleasure. Thank you, Scott.